Hello there, and welcome to this live stream event on the 18th of February 2020. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on board, and we're going to have a very interesting discussion this evening, a lot going on. We've got close to 130 people on the channel already, and more joining. I'm not going to acknowledge everybody now because they take too long, but welcome to you all. Thank you very much for giving up some of your evening to spend some time with me. And a very important time, I think, at the moment with all of the uncertainties that are going on at the moment. So, as normal, what I'm going to do initially is just run through a few quick slides. And then from there, we'll get into the Q&A section. So if you've got specific questions that you'd like to ask me, hold on to them for the moment. And when I've gone through the slides, I'll then come back to the Q&A. So just to sort of get the show on the road, as normal, the running order will just be this introduction, which won't take long, just on the house rules, a little bit about our models, because there are some people who may not know about the modelling that we do. A few key slides, which we're going to go through now. Then the Q&A, and Q&A is really the main part of this. So if you want to ask any questions, I'll try and answer them. If I don't know, I'll admit it. But, you know, I am quite well read in the subject area, and I've got quite a few opinions on things. So we'll try and share some of those. And then we'll sign off. Typically, this takes between an hour and 15, an hour and 30, but it might be a bit shorter if we run out of questions. But after an hour and a half, I run out of steam. So that pretty much is end of the show time. Just in terms of the house rules, I just want to highlight that this is not financial advice. I'm not qualified to give it. I'm not able to give it. I don't know your individual circumstances. This is based on my own analysis and research. It's based on my own opinions. But, you know, take it or leave it. But it's basically nothing around financial advice. If you need to get financial advice, go talk to a financial advisor directly one-on-one. Please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. The stream is being moderated. If we do have any difficulty, we will ban people. We don't like to do that. There are so many good conversations that go on, so many excellent ideas. There's no need for any of the racial slur stuff. So I hope that we can play nice. This is at the 18th of February 2020, so, you know, if you're watching this down the track, things may have changed, but it is as it is tonight. If you want to get my attention, do use Walk the World. There's always plenty of conversations going on, and very importantly, the conversations can sometimes go off down a few side alleys, which is great on the chat, but I won't necessarily engage unless you actually attract my attention directly. That's just the way that the system works, because otherwise it is very difficult to try and keep track of everything that's going on. I have enabled Super Chat, and that means that if you want to make sure you get my attention, or indeed if you want to make a donation to help with the work that we do here, then that Super Chat's a way of doing that. And I will just say that through the month of January, I did actually, as I said I would, accumulate all of the revenue from the DFA channel, and we made about $1,200 out of advertising and Super Chat and those things in the month. And I made that $2,000, and I sent the donation to the Faris to help with the bushfire recovery. So thank you very much, one and all those who watched the shows during January, or indeed contributed directly to the channel in January. You've helped me make a contribution to the Faris, so thanks for that. Okay, just in terms of the core market model, this is the fundamental piece of research that we do. So we survey households and small businesses all the time. We put that information, plus information from all sorts of different sources, from the Reserve Bank, from APRA, from wherever else it comes, trading results, into our core market model. That's our modelling tool. And then from there, we drive our research. We publish reports. We do work for clients. And of course, all of the stuff that comes up on the blog and on the YouTube channels where I talk about my own material, it all comes through from that. So it is based on research. It is based on not just opinion, but real strong data. 52,000 households is some pretty good survey, 0.5% of all households in Australia. And that gives us a very good base from which to work. And we slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways, different property segments, different household segments, different geographic locators. So it's a bit like a Rubik's Cube. And it means that I can slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways. And in fact, we fund a lot of the work that we do around What the World by selling some of the data sets that we produce to a range of clients here and overseas. So that's sort of the economics behind what we do. Now, in terms of the Reserve Bank minutes today, they were very, very dovish. They came out, of course, today, third Tuesday, and they basically said that they couldn't yet determine the extent to which growth in China would be affected or the nature of the international spillovers. Now, of course, you know, that's true, and they didn't really do much. Interestingly, in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, when they published their statement on monetary policy, did do some more work on the potential impacts around the coronavirus. That was quite interesting, but the RBA has chosen to wait. They did say that GDP is still expected to pick up over the forecast period, but the growth forecast unchanged since November at 2.75% for 2020 and 3% in 2021. Now, that is quite aggressive relative to most economists, and indeed my own modelling is suggesting it's going to be closer to 2% rather than 3%, and that's before the coronavirus. So I think the RBA is very sporty when it comes to GDP growth. They did say that household consumption has been lower than expected, and they did also highlight the fact that slow growth in income was expected to continue and to weigh on consumption over coming quarters. So any wealth effect is pretty limited, and they're not necessarily banking any of that at the moment. They did also highlight the fact, and we see this in our business surveys, that business investment declined in the September quarter. The unemployment rate declined a little to 5.1%, although we'll show you some updated data there from Roy Morgan, which suggests that maybe the unemployment rate's now moving the other way. And the headline CPI is still well below their target band. The RBA has failed for a number of years to be able to meet their 2-3% inflation target. Now, there is a debate to be had whether, in fact, that's a sensible target anymore. But the fact is, that's one of the things that they get measured on, and they've failed miserably. Also, just worth highlighting the fact that they did make the point, and again, I see this in my data, that despite the lower interest rates, total mortgage payments have increased. And some of that is people paying back more than the minimum, but a lot more is the fact that new loans being taken out now are about 5% bigger than they were this time last year. You see that in the first home buyer data, 420,000, the average first time buyer loan in Australia this last month, and that was above 400,000, whereas a few months ago it was 300 and something. So, and we see that across the board. So I think that's quite interesting. They also made the point that home loan commitments for owner occupation continue to rise. There isn't much growth in investment borrowing, and I'll show you some more data on that shortly because that's quite important. The investment sector is still very compressed. A lot of property investors are still losing money on their property investments. And as a result of that, it's unlikely, I think, that that's going to change anytime soon. Then they also make the point that the questions about low interest rates and what happens with regard to monetary policy, and they did discuss what there's more debate going on globally about when you get to low interest rates, can you make monetary policy work? You know, if you try and take rates negative, that really doesn't work. Look at Europe, look at Japan. And therefore, as you begin to move rates lower, it becomes less and less likely that you're able to actually get the economic levers to pull the right way. And so they are quite coy now about taking rates lower. They probably will, and they probably will need to at some point, but it's unlikely that it will have much effect. And then they also made the point that the risks associated with the impact of very low interest rates can change resource allocations of people basically put more money into property, and so they're worried about the potential inflation of property prices. And frankly, Phil Lowe said a few times in the last few days that he's concerned about the fact that loans are getting bigger, home prices are going up while the overall economy is going backwards. So in a way, he's recognizing the problem, but then he created the problem with such low rates. And the other point, of course, is that savings rates are so low now, and in fact they keep going down. And I've done some more work recently looking at what real savings rates are. And many people are getting well below inflation on savings. In other words, if you've got money in the bank, you are now effectively losing money even with the current interest rates. And if rates were to go negative, of course, that would be even worse. So whilst the RBA is very dovish and they basically said they'll hold rates for some long time and rates will stay low for a long time, the fact is they're still way too optimistic. Now, just a few other points. Consumer sentiment still remains in the doldrums. We published our own financial confidence index, which was still very low, just a little bit up from last month. The data from the Melbourne Institute, Westpac Economics Melbourne Institute, was also very low. That's a combination of things, flat wages, cost of living, the bushfires, the concerns about the coronavirus, housing affordability, all those things are in there. And mortgage stress is also registering. Now, interestingly, I've had a few people say, well, hang on a moment, aren't defaults going down? Well, they are, and that's because interest rates have gone down, so people have a little bit more money in the bank. But the number of households that are finding it difficult to balance income and expenditure and manage their mortgages still is rising. 32.8% of households with a mortgage have difficulty now, according to our surveys. That's as hard as ever been. And the problem is that unless wages really start to lift up, we're never going to see that improve. Now, Roy Morgan's unemployment data came out today, and they said that in January, there was a really big lift in the unemployment rate from 8.7% to 9.7%. Now, of course, the Roy Morgan approach to unemployment measures it differently to the ABS, so it's always higher. And the ABS data was 5.1%, but the latest data from Roy Morgan suggests that unemployment is actually a lot higher. And if you then add unemployment and underemployment, in other words, not enough hours, people want more hours and they can't get them, then we have 18.4% of the working population in difficulty. And that's a huge deal. And that's one of the reasons why I am not convinced that we're going to see wages growth rising anytime soon. Business confidence remains under pressure. This is the NAB survey results. Both conditions and confidence are down. And if you look at the different segments, retail, construction are two segments that are really under pressure. Some of the drought-related impacts now are very strong, for example, in the agricultural sector as well. So there are very few sectors that are really feeling positive. And that was before the coronavirus hit. Now that, of course, is hitting other sectors too, and even the mining sector as well. So I think we're going to see business confidence remaining under pressure for some time to come. And the trade balance will also be under pressure. It was 5.2 billion positive in December, which was pretty good, a bit down from last time. But the iron ore price is now at 84. It was above 90. And for every $10 drop in the iron ore price, that's a 3.3 billion hit to the bottom line, according to my EFO. So if the iron ore price goes down and if the volumes go down as well, because China now is not receiving the imports that they were, then potentially we've got significant issues, as well as the drought, as well as the bushfires. So the chances are that we're going to see exports under pressure in the next few months, and that will have a significant impact in the balance of trade and therefore feed into GDP. New lending flows, this is the ABS data. Now, there was a lot of noise about, lending growth is taken off. Well, yeah, maybe. But if you look carefully at the data, and particularly if you look at the trend series, which is what I do, what's actually happened is there was a spike June, July, August, September last year. That was because of APRA's intervention, then the interest rate cuts. But we are seeing a slowing now of growth. And that's true for first-time buyers. It's true for owner-occupied borrowers. And it's true for property investors too. And in fact, property investors are turning down probably the most. So I'm not convinced that we've got a massive boom in lending at the moment. And there will be a bit of upside because of the first time owner grants, which we'll talk about in a moment or two. But nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that lending is still pretty weak and the growth is still quite low. And if you look at the annualized rate, it's still significantly down from where it was. So there isn't a massive boom in credit, despite what you read in the media. Now, the CoreLogic price index still, of course, is in quite positive territory. But in fact, if you look at the rate of growth across the index average, then it's actually sliding a little bit. In other words, prices are still going up, they say, but not so fast. And I've still got some big questions about the CoreLogic data series for the reason that some areas are definitely improving, but other areas are definitely not improving. And in fact, you have to look at types of property in individual locations. And as the discussion I had with Chris Bates yesterday made the point that, you know, you've got to get granular to really understand what's going on because these indices really aren't very helpful. So I want to be a little bit careful. I'd also make the point that some of the auction results that are coming out, been doing some more work on that. It looks to me as though there's some historical data sort of creeping their way into some of the sales data. So I'm not sure that the auction clearance rates, either by volume or clearance percentage, are as high as perhaps some are suggesting. But we'll keep an eye on that as we go forward. And just over to the Fed, it's important to understand that the Fed is still growing their balance sheet. So we had the repo event last September. John Adams and I are going to do a series on this because we think this is a very significant event. The fact is the Fed is now having to support the financial system and are still growing their balance sheet. They're buying more treasuries now rather than using the repos as much. But the fact is that there's half a trillion added to the Fed's balance sheet to try and keep the system afloat. So we've got the early signs of cracks that we had before the global financial crisis. And that's, I think, an indication that we are not in a well-balanced economy globally, never mind what's happening in Australia. Now, just in terms of our scenarios, and for those who haven't sort of followed this before, we actually drive a series of scenarios based off our core market model. And these scenarios are meant to be, if you like, an indicator of what's going on. It's not meant to be perfect. It's not a prediction. It's a way of just exploring different futures and considering the consequences. So it's not a forecast, but it does help to facilitate debate. And, you know, the scenarios may not be right. Things change. But we do actually update these on a monthly basis based on all the information coming out from all the sources. And we changed the methodology for the beginning of this year, where we were effectively running the scenarios forward from today rather than from a fixed point in history. And so we did change the baseline from a few months ago, but that's fine. And what we've also done now, because of what's happening around the coronavirus or COVID-19, is we run a separate series on the virus. And we'll talk about those as well just briefly. So in our scenarios, we basically have business as usual, which is as close to the RBA as I think is realistic. Then we have a scenario where effectively the local economy is still underperforming relative to what the RBA said. So growth is lower, unemployment's higher. And then we have another scenario where a more severe local event is happening, and that creates more financial pressure locally. And then we have a situation where we have an external event. It could be a liquidity event, or it could be some other thing, a trade issue, where effectively there are global factors beginning to spill over to the local economy. And nevertheless, in that particular scenario, banks essentially are bailed out and supported by governments around the world. And then the last one, which is what we call Iceland 2.0, is similar global problem, global shock, but now banks are allowed to fail. And in that scenario, which is what happened in Iceland, we get a more severe impact. So that's the scenario set. And we look at things like the cash rate, the unemployment rate, the amount of mortgage stress, the bank losses, home prices, the sorts of unnatural acts, as I call them. In other words, the sorts of things that central banks would be doing. And then I rate them on a relative probability basis. So yeah, we got there. So this is the first slide. So this is excluding the coronavirus. So basically, if we don't have a virus overhang, this is what I'm saying. So basically, not a huge amount of change from last month, really, insofar that I think the Reserve Bank cash rate will probably, in the next few months, go down to 0.5 in the Reserve Bank scenario. So they will cut at least once. Unemployment rate will go higher. I don't think they can get to 4.4%. I think they'll be closer to 5.5%. Mortgage rates will continue to rise a little. The bank losses will rise just a little. But there is still capacity in this baseline scenario for home prices on average to rise between 10 and 15% from where they currently are. There will be further credit rules, easing of credit rules, I should say, and further quantitative easing. In other words, putting more money in the system. And that has a 30% probability. The more likely one possibly is that we're going to see unemployment rise a bit higher. And we already saw unemployment begin to rise with the retail sector, the construction sector, some of the agricultural sectors under pressure, even before the coronavirus. And in that scenario, we end up with essentially not a rise in home prices, but a fall in home prices. So in some of my scenarios, I still think home prices are likely to fall from their current levels. There will be fiscal stimulus, there will be negative rates, possibly, and quantitative easing, 25% on that one. Then we go to a more serious depression, compression in Australia. And in that situation, the Reserve Bank would cut to its lowest bound, which is 0.25%. But the unemployment rate is likely to go higher, higher mortgage stress, higher losses. And now we're starting to see home prices significantly fall. And probably one of the banks would need to get bailed out in that scenario. Not going to say which one, but one of the big ones nevertheless. Then in our next scenario, this is now when we get that global situation. It could be something to do with liquidity, like that, for example. Let's assume the Fed is unable to maintain their stability in the US, or the China-US thing goes wrong, or something in Europe goes off. And in that scenario, we've got the situation now where we start getting compression in the system, liquidity dries up, and banks basically get into difficulty, and we would see a number of banks needing to be bailed out. And in that situation, prices could well drop 30 to 45%. And the reason that's important is because in absolute relative terms, if you see what I mean, prices in Australia are 40% over their long-term neutral values. If you look at what prices should be compared to what they are. So that's coming back to neutral value, 20% rating. And then the chances in Australia of a bank basically being allowed to fail, I think, is very low. It's a 5% rating at the moment. Simply because the banking system is so connected to government, and therefore those two things work together. And probably they wouldn't allow a bank to fail. They might allow a takeover or some other merger, but nevertheless, I think it's unlikely the bank would fail. But if you then bring in the coronavirus over the top, now, I've got to say, this is very, very speculative, and you know, I'm still tuning this model, but what I've assumed here is that essentially there would be scenario one, just a little local difference. In other words, mostly coronavirus is up in China, a little bit of overflow into other places, but really not a lot of local impact. In that situation, I think the unemployment rate would move up to about 5.6%. Home prices could still rise a little, but actually this is probably 5%. The next one would be then where the virus is more severe, but it's down in the Asian region predominantly, and only for a short term, so maybe for a quarter, a bit like SARS. And in that situation, later on, you'd find then quite a significant bounce back across through the year. The rate would probably be lower. The Reserve Bank would probably cut the rate. There would be a slight lift in employment, but home prices, again, could begin to fall. And I give that about a 20% probability. The third one, which is now getting quite serious, is where you have a regional spread of the virus, but it's still there 6 months later. So effectively, this is now something embedded and ground into the economy. And because of the international trading connectivity, that then has a very significant impact. The unemployment rate goes up, mortgage stress goes up because of it. Unemployment is just a trigger for mortgage stress. The bank losses would be higher. I still think it's likely in that scenario one bank could fail. And then this is the one that we should need to think about, what I call global disruption, which basically says it's not a total pandemic, but what it is significant enough to basically put a cap on a lot of trade around the world. So travel is pretty much still frozen. Many international businesses wouldn't be able to get stock that they need. And in that situation, they will definitely take rates as low as they can to zero. Unemployment still would rise higher. And in that situation, banks would be under significant pressure as a result of that. I give that a 50% probability based on what I'm seeing. And that's because I think that the trajectory that I'm seeing based on the predictions from some of the experts that I sort of take seriously is, the worst case scenario is certainly one that we probably should be thinking about. And of course, the really nightmarish one is it becomes a pandemic. So 2/3 of the world's population, get the virus, and the death rate still quite high. And that could be enough to basically put the whole of the economy around the world into significant collapse. So that's my sort of take at the moment. Now, I'll tune these, and it may well be that I can push the probabilities up towards the top of the table if, in fact, we get more confirmation, real confirmation out of China that the growth rates are sliding. But I'm at this moment assuming that the scenarios on the boat is more likely to be the true situation. In other words, the thing is more contagious, it's more easily spread than perhaps people want to recognise. So that's my sort of take at the moment. I'll update these scenarios later, but that's my sort of take on where we are at the moment. All right, so there you go. Let me now come back to the Q&A. Okay, Cookie Boy says, what's your call on the next GDP number? I'm going with minus 0.2%. Yeah, I think it will definitely be zero in the first quarter. It could be strongly negative. I'm seeing more data in my household surveys of small businesses being crushed by the output from the coronavirus. So, for example, a number of people working in, for example, fishing industry suddenly can't get their goods to go up to China. I'm seeing manufacturing industries saying we can't get supply stock from China for components that they need to be able to do what they do. We've also got now some imports not coming in, so effectively products that people were expecting to buy disappearing. And that's already happening. So I also think the education and the tourist sector is significant. I did a post on this some little time ago, and that's a very significant factor. The education sector is huge, of course. Tourism is pretty big, especially from China. So those two factors together could definitely create a significant problem. I think the GDP, therefore, will be negative in the first quarter. So I think your minus 0.2 is probably a reasonable stab. Could be worse. The iron ore price is down. The volumes of imports into China, both for coal and for iron ore and for LNG, seem to be de-accelerating. And you may have seen the post that I did where I called it Vironomics, where I was trying to get some real-time data information from things like congestion and things like air pollution in China to try and get a read of what's going on there. So these things are quite significant and definitely could have an impact. Now, Chris says, I've been on the phone to ADIs asking about their derivatives exposure, and they either can't or won't disclose it. Quite a challenge to understand ADI risk levels. Chris, you're absolutely right. Yeah, so the derivatives thing around the world is massive. In fact, nobody knows the total amount of derivatives that are in the system. And that's because they've changed the rules, and basically you don't have to disclose the total gross exposure in the derivatives now. You used to, but you don't have to. What you now do is to disclose the net exposure of derivatives, but only translated into on-balance sheet risk, which means that the amount of dollars sitting in the balance sheet relating to derivatives exposure is extremely small. And that means, essentially, that nobody knows how much is in the system. I'd also make the point that a lot of the derivatives are held by the large global banks, and a lot of them are saying that they're actually reducing their trading footprint. So, for example, HSBC published their results today, and they're down basically significantly on what people were expecting. But they also said that they're going to reduce their trading activities ahead. Deutsche Bank is doing the same. They're reducing their trading activities. But that means that there are a whole bunch of derivatives exposures that a lot of these international banks basically will have to unwind. We also know that hedge funds are involved in some of these too. And my hypothesis has been with regards to the US repo situation is that the liquidity problem was perhaps to do with hedge funds and their exposures rather than just the major banks. So derivatives, yeah, very, very hard. And if even some of the smaller banks in Australia have the derivatives exposure, so it's very hard. In New Zealand, there is this scorecard that actually the Reserve Bank in New Zealand has put up to try and actually give people better understanding of the risk profiles of each individual bank. We have nothing like that in Australia, no clear disclosure, and the accounting disclosures that the banks provide with regard to derivatives exposures and other types of exposures are very limited as well. So it's almost impossible to make an adequate risk assessment, in my view. And Cookie Boy's saying iron ore 85.49. Yep. And you think it was up at 120 some time ago. And in fact, if you look at the results from BHP that were sort of up till December, they made a huge killing because of the high iron ore price. But of course, it's lower now. And it could well be lower. Gary said first quarter could be minus 0.5 to minus 1. Yeah, it could be. It could be quite. Yeah, you know, the problem is there are too many moving parts to make a very good prediction yet. And we'll start getting flows of data, but I'm pretty sure that we will see unemployment rise. I'm pretty sure that we will see the consumer sector still very, very weak. I'm not seeing very much of an uptick in my surveys of people saying we're going to spend more. People are still paying down more on their mortgages, which is, not going to help in terms of the retail sector. And of course, we've been seeing a litany of retail stores and retail operations just disappearing, large ones, small ones. I saw on the post beforehand. The fact is that many retailers are really up against it. And my surveys are showing that they are really, really concerned about what's happening, plus the fact that now they can't necessarily get stock when they want to sell. So there you go. And Rolf said HSBC is one to watch if Hong Kong goes into recession. Indeed. Well, what's interesting about HSBC, they said they're going to actually reduce their operations in Europe and in the UK and focus on the Asian region, which I think is really interesting in the current environment. So I wonder how well that'll go. Okay, now Cookie Boy asked another question. Do you believe the free trade agreement was the main cause of Holland's demise? One of a number. So clearly, you know, if you go back a little bit, there was various government investment programs relating to trying to support the car industry in Australia. Some of those, I think, were not well thought through. But what they were doing was effectively supporting, rear-facing, in other words, current production cycles. What they should have done was to basically put the investment dollar into, electric vehicles and the next generation of vehicles rather than the last generation of vehicles. And the reason for that is that the costs of production in Australia are so much higher than in some other places. And, of course, a lot of the big motor manufacturers have moved their production to low-cost production centres. So the FTA is part of it, because, of course, that removes some of the tariff barriers. But a lot of it is just the international flow of manufacturing capability. Plus the fact that, of course, around the world, demand for vehicles is quite significantly down. So in Australia, we're seeing the number of new car sales falling. Same in the US, same in the UK. And, of course, we're now seeing a decline in China too. So there is an interesting question about future vehicles. But my point is we missed the opportunity 5 to 10 years ago to invest in the future, which should have been electric cars, in my view. Now, Andy says, will they just fudge the numbers? Probably they will. Interesting to say, do you fudge China's numbers? Well, we don't know. We sometimes think that maybe the fact of the matter is that, China could well be already in recession. That's one point. The second point is that our numbers come through, and of course we know that the CPI is rather artificially stated. We know that the employment numbers are probably understated relative to reality, so we've already got some sort of moving parts there. My suspicion is that the real issue is that we don't know yet, and there will be so many moving parts. And the real question is whether the coronavirus will be a short, mild thing, or whether it will be a long, deep thing. And of course, in those two scenarios, things are very different. Cookie's made the point. Thank you for that. Yeah, do put out what the world if you want me to see, because there are just so many questions going on, and I don't necessarily always get to all of them. Cookie's made the point also that competing for low wages doesn't help. Yeah, well, it's the sort of, what sort of economy do we want to have, of course, is the real question. We can't necessarily compete in areas that we used to be able to compete in, but the question is, what do we compete in now? And the fact of the matter is that whilst we still dig up resources and ship them relatively unprocessed to foreign buyers, we don't really do much in the way of added value stuff. So to my mind, the concept, for example, of investing in a hydrogen-based economy, for example, and some of the innovation around that, I think that's spot on. But we should have been doing that 5 years ago rather than just talking about it now. So we tend to be missing the boat, unfortunately. That means that our economy is very narrowly based. It's very trade-exposed, particularly to China, of course. And as a result of that, we are very, very precariously balanced at the moment, in my view. Nathan's asked, so do imported car prices surge with no local manufacturers? Well, we basically haven't been manufacturing much locally for some time, and in fact the unit price of cars have tended to fall, but of course there's been a switch towards the SUV market, which has a premium price to it. So most people, when they buy a car in Australia now, are buying SUV, and most people are still buying premium SUV rather than the cheaper end of the market. So what's happened is that we've got a different segment of the market, which means prices are higher. The other is, of course, that the price of the car is often as low as it can, but they make all the money on the servicing and things later as well. So that's the economics, I think, there. Now, Greg said, do you think the bushfire drop-off in tourism may be a silver lining if COVID really gets going? You mean less people come because they were not coming anyway? Well, it could be. You know, the fact is that we've now got almost no tourism from China. And, you know, of the 60 to 70 billion from tourism, you know, a good proportion of it, is 19, I think, as I recall from the top of my head, is from China. So that's a big number. But then on the other hand, if in fact, because of the bushfires, Chinese who may have been exposed to the virus chose not to come here, maybe that is a benefit. It's hard to know, isn't it? Too many hypotheticals, I suspect. So Tim says, a good friend of mine invests quite a lot in gold and other minerals. My question is, if the economy goes belly up, what stops the government taking people's gold? The short answer is nothing. There is the rule, I think from 1959, the law that says that in theory, gold could be grabbed. Probably won't be, but there is potentially could. You know, if you start talking about nightmare scenario, so let's assume that the economy basically does begin to tank. Let's assume, for example, that the Federal Reserve in the US is unable to keep the stability in the financial system that they've been trying to do. You know, you start to see things then deteriorating. Effectively, the currency takes a bath. Banks here then can't actually lend. They can't get the liquidity that they need. So they get into difficulty. That means that essentially the financial system then stalls a bit like it did in the global financial crisis. Then what happens after that is that the asset price bubbles, which we've had for a good number of years, supported by quantitative easing. I'm thinking here of stock market asset bubbles as well as home price price bubbles, turn. They go into reverse. And, you know, that 40% number is one I keep coming back to. 40%, because property is valued by over 40% above what it should be on a long-term basis. So that gives you a sense. Then the question is, what else do you hold, right? And, you know, a lot of people are saying we should hold metals. Then, of course, the question is, well, how do you price metals? Remember that the price of metals is linked to derivatives. So, you know, the trading of the underlying vis-a-vis the derivatives for gold, for example, is, you know, one to many. So there are many more trades than underlying. And if that market changes, then essentially we could see the price go higher, we could see it go lower, nobody quite knows. And then the other factor is, as you say, well, in a desperate situation, what would governments do? Well, they would probably clamp down on people's ability to transfer money between accounts or out of accounts and move money offshore. They will try and put limits on all sorts of things like that. And you can look around the world and see, you know, Lebanon, for example, and some of the South American countries where there are issues now. So, you know, let's hope we don't go there. But those more sort of more nightmarish scenarios are certainly ones that would follow from a significant disruption within the financial system. Okay. Let's have a look. This is from another one from Cookie. Yeah, you're busy tonight, Cookie. Sydney listings look like they've taken to hit the wall. It's been hovering around 16 to 16.8 listings in the past few weeks after a massive spike after holidays. Your thoughts? Yeah, interesting. So there was a very significant spike in my surveys of people's intention to list, which came through essentially before Christmas, saying we're going to list directly after Christmas. But what we then noticed, that tailored off. And I think it's partly because of the bushfires, it's partly because of the coronavirus, it's partly because of other factors. So it looks to me as though some of the people who were thinking of listing, particularly those who are what I call the downsizers, so these are people with a property who were thinking that they'll need to sell at some point and release equity, they're now saying, well, maybe now isn't the time. So we are seeing some of them now not list. So I should be watching these numbers very closely over the next quarter. And the other interesting factor, of course, is that if you look at the listings and then the reported sales and the auction clearances, there's a massive spike in terms of the number of listed clearances relative to those quoted, and we still haven't got to the bottom of that. So there's some funnies going on there in the numbers. But, yeah, I think listings are down. OK, what else have we got? then technically silver is okay. Well, certainly, Meg, there isn't the same RBA Act, the 1959 Act, for silver. So that's one of the reasons why some people advocate silver compared with gold. Then, of course, the question is, will silver go up, go down? You know, who knows? There are, of course, silver contracts too. There are a number of people who believe that silver is a more stable and therefore a less risk-laden solution. But my own conversation around those is that any solution, be it deposits, be it stocks, be it property, be it gold, be it silver, be it crypto, they've all got risks attached to them. So you can't avoid risk. And then you've got to try and make up a sort of a relative, you know, determination in your own mind as to where the risks are versus the rewards. And there's no easy answer to that. And I never give specific advice as to what people should do. All I'm saying is there is no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as a risk-free solution. And of course, the other question is that people need to trade up or trade off the asset protection, in other words, keeping the value I've got, versus asset growth and trying to take account of potential uplifts if index prices did move. And, you know, those two things pull in different directions sometimes. Right. Now, Greg says, how safe is superannuation from government utilisation in your worst-case scenarios? Okay. So the thing about superannuation is, of course, that it's held by large superannuation funds in trust for members. And I still am of the view that that nearly $3 trillion in superannuation, which, by the way, is often backed indirectly by the debt in the community. So just bear in mind, if you're putting 9% of your assets away into superannuation, you're not doing it, using it to pay down loans. So therefore, what that means is that basically you are using more debt and holding superannuation out over there somewhere. What that also means then is that the risk is that that $3 trillion, it gets so, you know, attractive that they will find a way to try and get their hands around it in some way. So, for example, there's talk about using superannuation to support property development, for example. There's various other things that I've seen. So, yeah, the problem with superannuation is they keep changing the rules. And the other point about superannuation, of course, is that the distribution of superannuation is actually very much skewed. So, you know, there's a small proportion of the population with very large balances. There's a very large proportion of the population with small balances. And the other point is that the returns on superannuation, which have been quite good because of the stock market performing, because of the quantitative easing, could change dramatically if, in fact, we find that the stock market crashes and if we discover that the quantitative easing processes don't work. So superannuation isn't by any means not risk-free. And so there's a bunch of questions, I guess. The other thing I think it's worth thinking about if you've got a superannuation fund with one of the big funds is get to ask them where it's invested. So is it invested in the markets? Is it invested in cash or some other thing? Because there are different types of risk profiles. And generally, unless you are specifically, you're put in one of the general funds, which may not be the right strategy for you, depending on where you are and what your risk profile actually is. Now, David's asked, and this is quite an important one, what's the chances of ScoMo lifting the China travel ban to get the students and tourists flowing again, even though we know we shouldn't? Well, I think there's a significant question here, because we know that many sectors of business, from the education sector through to the tourist sector through to the export sector, farming, mining, they're all basically complaining about the fact that their businesses are being hit because of the fact that there's a travel ban in place. And by the way, the travel ban that we've got here is somewhat similar to what they've got in some other countries, like in the US, for example. But in other countries, they haven't quite taken it as far. Now, ScoMo has said consistently that he's taking the advice of the medics and that he's responding to their recommendation. Now, I hope that there is no overt pressure on the medics to modify their medical opinion based on economics. Because if that does happen, then I think we're going to be completely messed up. My own view is that there is not enough evidence yet to show that this virus is under control. And therefore, if there was any move to turn the travel ban down, that would, I think, be of major concern. And I think there will be some significant contention between economics versus public health. But given what ScoMo did with regard to the bushfires and how he muffed that, I suspect he will err on the side of caution for now. But I wouldn't be surprised if at some point the business pressure is so great that he caves. Okay, so Genevieve says, do you have an opinion on the recent ABC 730 housing special? I reckon not a balanced piece and promoted the fear of missing out. I agree. No mention of mortgage stress, huge debt in retirement is not a solution. I agree. I was very disappointed with the ABC 730 series. They really didn't tell the full story. They definitely were, frankly, peddling property and really were highlighting the, a little bit of the stresses and strains around it, but it was more about missing out. People are so debted up. And as I made the point earlier on, you know, the average mortgage is now significantly bigger than it was just a few months ago. And we've got these very high debt ratios and we've got this very high level of unsustainable debt in the system, and yet nobody seems to care. And I find that, you know, frustrating. Now, I did some work with the ABC a couple of years ago on Four Corners, and we did a program on mortgage stress. And I rather hoped that that would actually ingrain, you know, within the ABC an understanding that this is a really important thing. But no, they don't want to really touch the mortgage stress story. They prefer the positive spin. So I'm afraid that's another fail. So I agree with you. I was very disappointed. Hey, Vincent, thank you for that. Appreciate it. Right. Now, Fat Cat says, what is your latest survey on consumer credit and credit card arrears? Is the consumer tapped out? Yeah, very interesting question there. I've got some really hot data, which I haven't yet shared on the channel, but I was asked to do some very detailed analysis looking at household consumer debt. So the buy now, pay later, the payday loans, the credit card debt and the unsecured personal credit. And I was astonished about what I saw, because what we are seeing is a lot of debt in multiple places that households have. So they have a mortgage, everyone knows about that, but they also have pools of consumer debt. And unfortunately, that consumer debt looks to me to be one of the main reasons why we've got issues. Now, what's fascinating is at a macro level, the total amount of consumer debt is going down, as the Reserve Bank numbers, but that is because we're seeing a huge rise in the buy now, pay later, which essentially, for example, you can basically have a transaction on the debit card, you buy what you want to buy, and then you pay in four installments. That isn't credit. That's not any of the credit numbers. And there's a large number of people now who actually have that type of facility, and multiple cards in some cases. And about 20% of them end up paying penalty fees because they don't pay all the time. And quite a lot of those balances are quite high now. So I'll get into that in more detail in a future show, because I think it's quite important people understand the full debt profile. And again, it's one of the things I keep saying. DFA looks at things from the total household footprint. So all the debt, wherever it is, whatever mixture it is, and the implications of that debt. Many other people don't. And that is, I think, a major problem. And whenever I talk to the regulators around this, as I do quite often, they don't think it's a significant issue. But what's interesting now is that some of the politicians are beginning to wake up to the fact that this is a big issue. So watch this space on that. I will make a show on that in due course. And I will, by the way, also do some geomapping of this. And I will, by the way, come back and do some more geomapping on mortgage stress. It's just that I'm running out of time with a few other things that are going on at the moment, about the cash ban, for example. Okay. What else have we got? Christopher Manning, you star. Thank you so much. Really appreciate that. It will make a huge difference to our ability to make more great content. Now, Cookie Boy says, I've said this a few times on Twitter. Do you believe a cash ban was implemented? Could people withdraw dollars and send a bank broke? Yeah. So what we know is, from experience in Europe and other places too, that when banks get into difficulty, people try and get their money out. Now, what they tend to do is to put blocks on how much you can get out. So they'll say you can make it, you know, $100 or $50 from the ATM on the day, which is what you did in Greece. They won't allow large transactions out of the banking system because they want to try and protect, essentially, the banking system. So now, if you go back to Northern Rock, you know, in the UK, just more than a decade ago now, there were queues of people outside the bank. And basically, people said, well, you can tell me that it's safe and you can tell me that it's guaranteed by the government, but I don't believe it and won't take my money out. There is definitely a risk, and therefore the cash ban and other activities could be definitely seen as part of a strategy to protect the banking system. I fear that's the case, and one of the reasons why John and I are so keen on talking about the cash ban and getting this bill killed is because it lays the foundation for negative interest rates, forcing people into the banking system and essentially controlling the amount of cash, because they could turn off more than $10,000 in cash in or out of a bank just by changing a line on a regulation. You don't need government approval for that. And remember that the cash ban also has up to 2 years in prison, and it's not that it's sort of, you know, tested in court like many other cases. Here, it's a binary. If you did it, then you stand the risk of going to prison. And that amount of prison time for this type of crime is just unheard of. And that's why a lot of the people, like, for example, in the legal profession are also opposing the cash ban too. And I sort of say, if you haven't picked up the phone and spoken to your senators and said, oi, this cash ban is not fair, it reduces our ability to do things today, so in other words, reduces our civil liberties, it's in preparation for negative interest rates, and it's to do with controlling the, you know, financial system, it has very little to do with money laundering and tax leakage. And if you really want to focus on tax leakage, focus on the real estate industry and focus on the top end of town rather than small businesses and cash transactions. I mean, there are so many videos we've done on this, but, you know, this is still a live issue. We've got till the 28th of February. So I'd encourage you, if you've not done so, it's worth picking up the phone, talking to your senators and just saying, oi, this is not cricket. Vincent, thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. I'm just going to read your question now. Do you think new builds are too risky right now in Melbourne and elsewhere? They seem on pay to be cost-effective. Okay, Vincent, do you mean new build houses or do you mean new build apartments? So we know that the quality of construction in many new build apartments is still very poor. And so if you were thinking of buying a new build apartment, it's really, really important to go into detail about the building firm and the building standards and get the right inspections done before you actually sign on the dotted line. There are some really good builders out there who've built really good properties, but a lot of it has been thrown together with relatively substandard components, often from Asia, and even could, for example, contain asbestos. And some of the cracks that we're seeing in terms of the high rises are not visible on day one because the building settles. And so even if you buy a property that's a few years old, you've still got the risk. So the survey data that I'm seeing suggests a lot of people are very nervous about apartments, particularly high-rise apartments. Now, new build houses still potentially have some of the same risks because essentially they can still be using poor quality components, but the risks are probably a little lower. But generally, my thoughts are that buying new is often more risky than buying old. And it's like when you drive a new car out of the showroom, you lose, you know, 20% on day one. And you quite often, although the price may look attractive to start with, ask yourself, why is it that that price is where it is? Quite often now, the developers are absolutely desperate to sell. And they're still deeply discounting in some areas, particularly in some of the high-rise areas. And they'll even do things like, guarantee rentals if you want to buy it as a rental property for a length of time. They're doing that because there's an air of desperation. We've got 220,000 units coming on stream over the next year. And that's enough to put quite considerable pressure on prices. So that's the other point I want to make, is if you're buying now and you're buying into effectively one of many units, when you come to sell, you've got real issues. And again, listen to Chris Bates. He went through this in some detail yesterday on the DFA channel, where we discussed the issue of if you're trying to sell and you've got something unique, you've got a leverage point. But if you're trying to sell something which is one of a million, very, very hard, and therefore you can risk quite a lot of money in the process. Okay, what else have we got? Reason why I ask, this is Cookie. Reason why I ask, let's say someone's 250K over 25 days, they could withdraw all the dollars. Now, times it by 1,000. Yeah, no, you're right, people did. When people started drawing out cash well before the Cyprus situation blew up. Also true in the UK as well. So, you know, the banking system is about confidence. And if people no longer have confidence in the banking system, then essentially people will want to take money out, and particularly in the low interest rate environment, because you're not actually getting much in return at the moment. And at least if you've got the money, then you can chance to use it, unless you, of course, the cash ban, because the cash ban says, ah, oh, but more than $10,000, if it comes in, you won't be able to actually do anything with it once you've got it. I think I also want to just, you know, counter, I'm not saying to anybody, go rush out and draw all your money out of the bank. I don't think we're in that situation yet. You know, I've still got money in the bank at the moment. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. I think that the banking system here in Australia is still relatively strong relative to some other areas around the world. And the chances are that the government would not want to see the banks fall over. But remember that we've still got the bail-in as well as the bail-out scenario. The bail-in is where effectively deposits are converted to equity. That is still alive here. It's still not being tidied up. And so there are some risks there. But trying to triangulate those risks and to understand the significance of them is the trick. My own view is there are some risks, but I don't think they're huge at the moment. But, you know, we'll keep watching it. And if things bubble up towards a crisis, then, you know, that may change. But anyway, as I say, at the moment, I'm happy with money in the bank. Now, somebody's there, asked, I can't pronounce that handle, so I'm not going to try. Will overseas buyers save the property market? Interesting question, that, because, you know, we did have a very strong and buoyant property market for quite a long time. And that was supported by particularly Chinese buyers and other overseas buyers. And then we started to see them turn away. And then the property investors started to move out. And then the APRA tightened the lending standards. And that then put downward pressure on properties. And as a result of the property price falls, then you started seeing more investors walk. And that was the sort of the cycle. And we're in the situation now where most of the property cycles are actually still looking pretty in the doldrums from an investment perspective, and rental streams aren't very strong. Now, what is true is that the interest from overseas sources before the coronavirus was getting quite strong. So we were seeing more people interested in Australian property again, particularly as prices were moving up. The early evidence with regard to the coronavirus is that that's definitely put that on hold at the moment. And given the fact that the economics within China and beyond could well be quite different you know, in a few months, years, whatever. My own feeling is that we're not going to see a huge international movement to buy property in Australia. Now, obviously, Sydney and Melbourne and a few other areas are always regarded as an international, you know, exciting place to buy property. But then there are some other places too, like in Canada, although they've put some changes in there. In the UK, they're still attracting foreign buyers there and a few other places too. So I'm not sure that we're going to see a massive turnaround. And my own view of the investment property sector is we're going to see it remaining quite compressed and under pressure for quite some time because of local and international situations. Okay, let's have a look. Cookie asks again. Hey, Cookie, you're definitely busy tonight. Your thoughts on Bendigo Bank, the early signs of financial stress? Well, yeah, you know, I said for quite some time, I think, as you may recall, that Bendigo Bank was under pressure. they've got the problem of being subscale. They've got the problems of their multiple brands. In fact, if you look carefully at the results, and they've just, of course, they're in trading halt at the moment as they raise more capital to meet the cash flow ratios. In fact, what they've done is they've reduced the interest paid on deposits differentially more than many other lenders in Australia to try and bolster their margins. And they're trying to lend their way out of trouble, particularly writing mortgages. Now, the question then is, do they have sufficiently powerful risk underwriting processes in their organisation to understand what they're getting into? That's the open question. I don't know, but I'd have my suspicions. And I also think that they still have a subscale issue. But then everybody has been competing very hard for the mortgage lending. You know, CBA has grown their book very significantly. Some of the others have less so, particularly investor mortgages. Macquarie's very, very aggressively lending at the moment. So effectively you've got, you know, Macquarie on one side and then you've got Bendigo on the other side. Wonder which of the two would actually be doing a better result. So I'll be watching Bendigo, but I'm still quite sceptical of their ability to really pull the ship around. The liquidity that they will create from their raising will help in the short term, but the underlying dynamics of being a small bank with a limited balance sheet and a need to lend puts them, I think, into what I call a more troublesome class, along with some of the other regionals, by the way. We've got to watch those very carefully. I've always said to people, you know, if you're interested in looking beyond the big four, then I would also look beyond some of the regional players too. I prefer some of the smaller building societies and credit unions who have a much less aggressive profit-driven agenda. They've got a more flexible capital structure and they tend to actually pay better rates on deposits and even their mortgage rates are quite good. So maybe worth looking at some of the smaller players. Michael says, great show, Martin. Question, is there any data either you can't get your hands on or is simply not available? If so, what would it be? And thank you very much for your support there, Michael. Yeah, so there are three things that I struggle with. The first is all of this issue about derivatives exposures. That is something which is really, really hard to get hold of. We don't really understand, nobody understands all of the risk exposures that the banks have. The second is that the way that the banks are marking to market their loan portfolios and particularly their exposures to property, I find very troublesome because they tend to use very high level SA3 or SA4 level property price moves, courtesy of CoreLogic or somewhat similar, which tends to mask all of the movements in value. There is no clear way of being able to get inside the loan portfolios of individual lenders, and therefore we don't know what they're doing in terms of what they're propping up, to what extent they're actually, you know, being positive about the value of property in their portfolios. And indeed, even if loans are going bad, what steps are being taken? We think there are steps that are being taken below the waterline to essentially mask defaults and mask problem loans at the moment. And that's everything from deferring interest payments and other things. Those sorts of factors are not adequately disclosed. And interestingly, APRA is talking about more disclosure around some of these things, but we'll have to wait and see whether that really comes through. So that's those two. The third thing is that what I find interesting, I get very rich information with regards to households and their spending and households and their commitments. So I've got a very good feel on households and household budgets. But the problem I've got is that the work that the RBA does and many other official organisations, they'll use the HILDA data, which is 3 years old. So there's an information gap on their side, right? Because they're not using up-to-date information for a lot of their analysis. So every time you see APRA or the Reserve Bank saying, you know, household finances are fine, etc., that's based on three-year-old data. So there's a big information gap in the official data sets. And my own view is that's deliberate. There are other sources like my own sources of data. And I have shared some of my data with Reserve Bank and other organizations. But nevertheless, on an ongoing basis, they prefer to use the HILDA data. So that for me is really troublesome. So we have a whole bunch of, you know, knowns, unknowns and unknowns unknowns simply because of the data deficiencies that we have in Australia. And by the way, we're not alone. Other countries have somewhat similar things. And it's also worth thinking about some of the data sets only come out once a quarter, whereas in other countries they come out once a month. So we don't necessarily get as good a read. And even the APRA data on the quarterly basis from the banks is 2 months late. The house price data from ABS is 2 months late. So, it's 5 months behind by the time it comes through. So we are getting still delayed data, and that's another problem. Okay, what else have we got? This is CDL. I was told property doubles every 7 years, so when should I invest next? You really believe that property doubles every 7 years? It's very, very interesting. I see that too, insofar that in the surveys, that's one of the things we get to, people still believe it, and there's no evidence. We had an artificially induced run-up in home prices over a period over the last 20 years or so. That was abnormal. And that's because of the deregulation of the financial system, the cutting interest rates, the very poor lending standards, and a bunch of other things too, right? That's abnormal. If you go over the longer term, if you look at over the last 100 years, house prices have never doubled every 7 years. There were two periods. The first period was directly after the war, and the second period was when the deregulation happened in the last few years. So we've got those two periods where there was a very significant run in home prices, but that is atypical of the longer term. So the question you then have to ask yourself is, given where we are and given the fact that house prices are very high at the moment, what is the chance of pricing doubling from where they are today over the next 7 years, right? Which essentially would mean that in Sydney, the average price would be $2 million, right? I think that's extremely unlikely over that period. I think it's more likely that prices will go sideways or will fall. I still think that prices are more likely to fall. But I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see anything like the acceleration that we had. So capital growth is not assured into the future. And anybody who says it doubles every 7 years, I think you just, that's history. It's not looking ahead. So that's my own view. Okay, here's another one. Could you please share your thoughts on the current interest rate levels when comparing them to historical levels? Sure, yeah. So look, the fact is, interest rates are lower than they've probably ever been. And there is a very interesting story here insofar that 3 or 4 years ago, the Reserve Bank said that there was emergency level down to about 3% on the cash rate. They said, that's very, very unlikely to be for very long, but we just got to do something. Now they're taking rates down to 0.75% and they're still saying it could go lower. That's because around the world, we've had quantitative easing running like mad since the global financial crisis. Now, quantitative easing was effectively central banks putting liquidity into the markets to support the financial system after the global financial crisis, rather than addressing the root causes of the financial crisis. And as a result of that, we saw interest rates driving down, plus the fact that we've now got the situation where we've got more people saving because of the demographic shifts as they move into the older age groups and have got basically more money. So there's more savings chasing returns. And we've also got huge amounts of financial speculation through derivatives and through some of the other financial engineering that's going on. All of those things are changing the nature of investment. So interest rates in terms of cash, very low. In terms of overall returns, stock markets are doing well, probably doing, well, okay-ish, but as I said, unlikely to arrive dramatically, and that's because of quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, what it does is it devalues everything, but it just lifts the numbers. So the numbers get bigger, but the value doesn't increase, right? And that's the thing about this sort of what's called fiat money. In other words, it's not based on anything real. It's just based on opinion, basically, as to what it's worth, right? So what we've got is this run-up in value. We've got very, very low interest rates, historically low, and will stay low for a long, long time. But those low interest rates have a consequence for savers, so it's very hard to get real returns on deposits. In fact, it's impossible these days to get above inflation on deposits, even on term deposits. although I do still have a term deposit from a few years ago, which is, I think, 6% or something, so we're doing quite well on those for a little while longer. The point there is, though, that the overall returns are very low. Loans are also cheaper than they were, so people basically can borrow more. And the very process of borrowing more then lifts prices even higher and continues this cycle of asset expansion, and the debt bomb gets bigger and bigger. But the trouble is, the debt ultimately becomes unmanageable, and that's the process that we're going through at the moment. Rates will go lower, they'll go sideways, then probably go deeply negative at some point, and then we'll see what happens. But no, interest rates in absolute terms as low as they've probably ever been. Now, this is from Harold. Latvia had a property bust in 2009, but it cut government spending by a quarter and rebounded from recession. Now it's more economically complex than Australia. Yeah, great example. Latvia and indeed Iceland, two really interesting examples, because the true story here is that if we just continue to follow what everybody else is doing and take rates lower and just keep pumping more liquidity into the marketplace, we're going to create a massive problem, because what we're trying to do is to sustain an unsustainable bubble, and basically trying to keep all the balls in the air for longer, but it just builds and builds and builds and gets to the point where it's unsustainable. Sometimes the right answer is to take the medicine and essentially deal with the situation more directly. So, for example, in Iceland, they let banks fail. They didn't bail them out. They said, that's just the way it's got to be. And there was a short period of pain, but then the economy started to recover and power away. So there is a different path that we could steer, but it's politically very hard to sell, because politicians don't want to be on the watch when house prices slide. They don't want to be on watch when effectively the economy goes backwards, right? So they'll do everything they can to try and keep the bubble going. Look at ScoMo at the moment, trying to keep the property bubble going because they want the wealth effect, because that means that people will feel more wealthy. Trouble is, it's not real wealth. It's just basically bubbling ever higher to create a bigger problem later. The medicine what we have to take is to reset back to proper, more realistic levels. Like I say, we're 40% overvalued in real terms, and that's something ultimately we'll have to come back to deal with. So how we get there is the question. And unfortunately, there are very few politicians and almost no central bankers who really want to deal with those sorts of issues. Okay. Vincent says, hi, Martin. Most of the press seem to be spruiking property in Australia and New Zealand. Do you think the rises are grossly overstated or just selectively reported? Very good question. Vincent, I think the truth is that there are some rises in some places. So, for example, we know in the upper end of the market in around Sydney, that dropped about 20%, has now recovered by almost that amount, 15% higher. But they're very small volumes of transactions. We also know that in other locations, there have been quite a few transactions where people have settled and sold 2-3 years ago and have lost money. You never hear about those. And in fact, you never hear the full story. So basically, you hear the stories of the ones that made money and prices are going up, but you never hear the other side of the equation. I can point to you still to postcodes and types of properties that are still 20% down from where they were. Over in the West, in Perth, there are properties that are 30% lower. And even in New Zealand, where there has been some price moves up, it's not universal. And, if you look carefully, there are some places where prices are still low. So, unfortunately, the media and the property sector are very, very close. And, here in Australia, we have the situation where big media companies are connected with big property companies. And so they're talking it up. They're talking their book, basically. We also know that those organizations are aligned to the government. We know that the government wants to take prices higher because they want to apply the wealth effect. And in fact, ScoMo promised election commitment, prices will go higher. So, it's hard to fight against that, but we're not getting the full story. And you have to go granular to really understand what's going on. But as I say, the truth is, there are places where prices are doing quite well, particularly in and around Sydney and Melbourne, houses close into the centre ring, where there's limited supply, where there's quite strong demand. If you look at units, if you look at outer suburban properties, very different story. And I could, you know, have the same discussion about areas in New Zealand. Okay, what else have we got here? I'm just looking. So Tim's asked, did you get into Ripple a few years back? What is your crypto investing opinion, if any? Yeah, okay. So I do follow the crypto area, and you know, I've done quite a lot of research about this. The fact of the matter is that the crypto area is more about speculation than anything else. It may go up, it may go down, and there are different flavors of cryptos, and there are some that are actually more stable than others. But the fact of the matter is the crypto community is one where speculators can have their head. And, you know, you might well do well. And, you know, the value of Bitcoin is up significantly compared with 5 years ago. But, of course, it went way up, back. And so the volatility is very high. And it's interesting that there was a paper that there was the Bank of England published quite recently highlighting the fact that that very speculation that drives the cryptocurrencies makes it very unlikely that cryptocurrencies can be real a form of money, because the value moves so much, and it's actually the speculation that stops it becoming a more appropriate form of money. Now, there are some types that are actually trying to be more like money. So far, I haven't seen much evidence. There's also another factor here, and that is that, of course, we're seeing more and more central banks talking about a central bank digital currency. In other words, a digital dollar. In Australia, for example. And in fact, the Reserve Bank has now done some early experiments looking at cryptocurrencies in the context of the Aussie dollar. There's a reason why people might want to do that. And it's to do with the fact that the risks could be along the lines. By the way, there's a big thunderstorm going on at the moment. So if I suddenly go off air, it'll be because the power's gone off. So you know, you could see the situation where the central banks start putting digital currency in place. In fact, there is a strategy that you could argue could be there that says we want people to have to use the banks, look at the cash ban. We want to make it harder for people to actually use cash, and then we actually provide a digital alternative for them to essentially use, right? That could be a strategy that some would argue is really the long play. And then you've got things like Facebook-backed Libra, which basically is a cryptocurrency backed by a basket of currencies. And you know, there's arguments about for it and against it. My own view is the privacy issues around having transactions related to what Facebook knows is a problem for me. But that's another story, perhaps. So the short answer is cryptocurrencies are more about speculation than anything else. They may go up, they may go down. And, you know, if you want to put a bit of money in there and see where it goes, good on you. But don't think of it in the same, breath as notes or gold or silver or even stock market assets. They're not behaving the same. They will not behave the same. And I know that some people are saying, well, that's true now because they're quite small, but when they get bigger, they'll actually take more of the characteristics of money. So far, there's no evidence of that being the case. So I'm a little bit skeptical, a little bit cautious. It's more about speculation. Okay. Now, predictions for the Aussie dollar by the end of 2020. On Twitter, I've seen 64 cents. Yes. It could go one of two ways, you know. It really could. We could see the Aussie dollar below 60. On the other hand, if in fact some of the other things go the other way, you know, the Aussie dollar is seen as a bit of a proxy for China because of our strong trade relationships with China. And so one of the reasons why the Aussie dollar is quite strong and why it's being mirroring more strongly the US than people expect is because of that relationship. So if people continue to see Australia as effectively a proxy for investing in China, then it could go higher. And as China, if China escapes from the crypto virus quite early and their economy bounces back, and they make a lot of it significant investments, and a lot of that comes into Australia, I could see a scenario where we're quite a lot stronger. But net-net, it's more likely to be weaker, I think. Glenn C says, solar plus battery is blackout protection. I've had it for a while and it works. Yeah, I did have looked at it. Actually went as far as getting a number of quotes to basically put a whole system in that would make me completely stand alone. There were two problems. The first problem was that the ability to be able to cut across in an emergency, as it were, there was still a little bit of a cutover, and they couldn't find a way of guaranteeing that there wouldn't be enough of a cutover to basically turn everything off. So, first point. Second point was that the site we've got here is quite interesting because we've got a large roof, but it's very screened by trees. And so it was very complex to try and get a solar array that would actually be effective without paying an arm and a leg for it. And then the battery part of it was quite expensive. So I haven't done anything yet, but I've been looking. So it's on my list. Right. This is from Nathan about the gig economy. How does the gig economy feed into economic and employment data? Lots of casual looks like delivery, etc. Yeah. Well, Nathan, my data shows that more and more people are actually in the gig economy and indeed doing zero contract hours and quite often doing multiple part-time jobs. And that information is coming through in my surveys. It doesn't come through clearly enough in the ABS survey data, in my view. There isn't enough information, although they do talk about, you know, underemployed versus fully employed. But the fact is that this is a big deal. And yes, you're right. People often are getting paid less. They're not getting some of the benefits that they would get in full-time employment. And of course, there's a big debate about whether a gig economy employment is contractual employment or not, and et cetera, so that will play out ahead. But the factual situation is that more people, particularly younger people, are on these part-time gig economy roles, and that creates a really, really big issue. And it does have a very debilitating effect on people's finances, on their ability to be able to save for the future, and a bunch of other things too. Okay, what have we got here? Okay, this is from Harold. Thanks for answering, Marty. My perspective is Austrian. I think the cure for our long-term structural problems will be cutting government spending, taxes, as well as cutting property market interventions. Yep. The truth is that the alternative, which is more and more central bank government support and, you know, bigger debt bombs, is not working. Look at Japan. Even the US, you know, the economy there superficially looks good, but it's not really very good. One of the main reasons why the stock markets are rising so quickly is that people are borrowing cheaply as companies and then putting that money to buy back shares, and shares are going up. So they're actually going up not because they're actually creating more value, but simply because they're artificially manipulating their price by buying back shares. Not good. And the real question that I have is, we need an alternative path, right? We need a different way of thinking about the economy. One, it needs to be more broad-based. Second, it needs to be more innovative. And thirdly, what we need to do is we need to get out of the idea that somehow government's going to solve everything all the time, right? Because the fact is, the more that governments try to intervene and do things, my own read is that they make a bigger mess of it. And effectively, they create more and more difficulty. I mean, look at the tax structure that we have in Australia. Look at all the tax breaks that big organisations are getting at the moment. That's all because of government intervention in the tax system. My own view is it would be much better to get out the way, get government out of the way, and basically, you know, think differently about the economy. But that's a very, not very popular thing to say, but I personally think that government often creates more issues than they solve. Another one from Cookie Boy. Hey, you're hot tonight. Do you have any data on commercial rental stress for tenants struggling to pay leases? Yes, I do. So within the SME survey, I have a lot of information on commercial stress. There are more businesses in difficulty than we've had forever. In fact, I did a submission quite recently to the Senate, whose inquiry into SME funding. They had this nutty idea where they should create an investment fund with five banks, and then they would invest in a small number of large SMEs and basically give them funds to help them grow. And I said, no, you're missing the point. That isn't where the real need is. So it's the lower end of town. It's that small business that's struggling with rent, struggling with lease payments, struggling with rates. They're the ones that are really struggling at the moment, and we need to find a way to figure that out differently. So yeah, it's a big deal. And by the way, you can correlate it with rent, with the retail sector, construction sector, manufacturing sector, and you know, all the other things. And there's an interesting correlation between the leasing stress with the mortgage stress. So some of the same postcodes have both areas under in difficulty. Harold Gray, you're preaching to the choir. Government is pure incompetence, wasteful spending, and pork barreling. That about sums it up, Harold. Yeah, we need to find a different way, right? That, you know, the thing I get so frustrated about is that the potential we have here in Australia, with, you know, our creativity and our ability to do things and the natural resources and everything else, is huge, and yet somehow we seem to just mess it up, and basically end with you know, the outcomes. We've got a very narrow-based economy. We're backward-facing rather than forward-facing. We're reliant on old industries rather than new industries. We just miss the boat, and it's because the political process doesn't allow for vision. It doesn't allow for future orientation, and that's one of the reasons why we've got all the issues we have at the moment, in my view. Hey, well, it's nearly 9:30. I'm still looking at these questions. I'm not sure how much more any more I can go with. Michael says, thanks, Martin. You need bank executive on your show to disclose if you can find one. I'm shocked the data is up to 3 years old. I agree. It is remarkable, and it is a real problem. Is the US stock market now a proxy for money growth compared with value? Yes, absolutely. So the stock market has nothing to do with fundamental value. So if you look at the analysts now, they're basically saying, it's about momentum, right? So basically, the prices will go higher because they'll go higher because the Fed will support it, or because the central banks will support it. Fundamental value has disappeared. So the PE ratios and things don't tell us the full story now. There's something else going on there, and it's all about the asset inflation simply because of the quantitative easing. In other words, it's the devaluation of real money in the process. And this is from Glenn C. Further to tenant quest, what about tenants questioning landlords' ability to maintain their mortgage? Yes, that's right. Well, interesting question, isn't it? Because if you are a tenant and your landlord has a financial issue, then it hits you. So, interesting question. It doesn't tend to be how the way the process goes at the moment. Although, of course, at the moment, there is more supply of rental than we've had for a long time, and rents aren't going up. So it actually puts more opportunity for potential tenants to perhaps ask a few more questions. Okay. Well, I'm just going to switch back to the rest of the show. I must say that, as always, there's plenty to talk about, and I haven't been able to go through my questions again, so I'll have to come back. But I just want to do a couple of closing comments, and then I'll take one more quick look at the questions. So just, if you like what you hear here and you'd like to get more information, the DFA blog contains a whole lot more information. All of my posts are there, and you can also subscribe and get updates every time I post a blog. You can also support what we do. We don't make money out of doing what we do here. This is simply about providing our thoughts and insights, but there's some costs involved. So if you feel like supporting us, you can do it via Patreon, where you can subscribe on a monthly basis. Different levels get different types of subscriptions and different types of content. You've got access to extra content through Patreon, and so, you know, have a look at that if you would like to subscribe on an ongoing basis. That at least means that we get some support each month. Or if you want to make a one-off donation, you can do it via PayPal. Some people do that just because it's easy. Or indeed, you can use Bitcoin. So somebody asked about crypto. We do have a Bitcoin account, and that's how you can contribute to that if you'd like to do that. We put that up because a few people said, why don't you do Bitcoin? So we do. In terms of top hits, just highlights China austerity or stimulus. If you've not seen that post, really important, because basically the West is assuming that the central bank in China will bail out China. The central bank in China seems to be saying we probably won't fundamental dichotomy there as to the future strategy, and it's worth watching that post simply to see the two sides of the equation. I did a post on property's catch-22, which was basically highlighting why it is that property is being spruiked so much by everybody and some of the risks attached to it. It's worth watching that. Our mortgage stress mapping show. I know that people ask for a whole bunch of more information on mortgage stress mapping. I've got another show to make on that, which I'll do to talk about some of the regional areas. I just ran out of time, but we'll try and do that. There's also the real-time Vironomics show, which is where I actually showed some real-time data flows from things like traffic congestion and pollution in China to try and get a read on what the economy was doing. We'll keep monitoring those ahead to see whether we get a rebound in terms of activity or not as the coronavirus issue develops, but worth watching that show. With John Adams, we've done a series on bail-in, bail-out, deposits, deposit insurance, all of those things. There's three shows there on the Interest of the People channel. Recommend you watch those. And if you've got money in the bank, read the one here, particularly on the bank's terms and conditions, because the fact is that most banks' terms and conditions have been changed now to make it easier for them to grab your deposits immediately or change things without notice. So very important to read the terms and conditions. And finally, Chris Bates and I chatted yesterday about the property sector. Chris is really good value. He's a mortgage broker. He's a real estate a guy and a wealth advisor as well. And Chris is quite balanced in what he says. He's in the property market. He's talking about Sydney, but there's some quite interesting messages there. And by the way, I've got a few other shows to record with people like Tony LeCantro, for example, and a few other people too. And people have been asking about Joe Wilkes. We're trying to get Joe Wilkes back. He's just very, very busy at the moment. And a few other people who were on the show last year, we're trying to get them back as well. Just, you know, go with me. we'll try and sort that out. And I think that's pretty much it. So just to say that the next show will be on the 17th of March. So that's the third Tuesday, 17th of March, 2020, 8 p.m. Sydney time. So we'll be back to talk about the issues to do with the Reserve Bank and what they say in their March decision. And we'll know more about the coronavirus. We'll update our scenarios and update particularly the ones around the coronavirus. And happy to take more questions at that point. I'm just going to come back one more time to the stream and just see people be asking about Holden. I haven't really got time. I may do a show on Holden, Troy, because I think it's quite an important story. And it really does. It's a microcosm of the problem we have in Australia with the way that we've thought about our business, I think. Okay, what else have we got? I think we're there. Yeah. Okay, well, I probably haven't answered all the questions you've asked, so I apologise for that, but hopefully the ones that I have been helpful and useful. I just want to say thank you so much for spending time with me on the show again. Conversation has been, from my perspective, quite interesting and, you know, some interesting points raised. I hope you found it helpful too. Continue to follow our shows on both the Interest of the People channel with John Adams. We've got some breaking stories in the next few days. We'll continue to talk about the cash ban and other things. And on DFA, we'll continue with the data-driven approach and essentially tell a little more about what's going on with regards to the economy and with everything else that's happening, a lot going on. So thank you once again for spending time with me tonight, and have a good evening, and we'll see you next time. It's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. See you next time.